6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Some matches are temporary, but your privacy shouldn't be. With Line 2, you get a second phone line just for dating. No need to share your personal number until you're ready. You can chat, text, and even block numbers, all while keeping things fun and private. It's perfect for online dating, blind dates, or just keeping things light. When you're ready to move on, Line 2 lets you cut ties without any drama. Dating should be fun and carefree. Line 2 keeps it that way. Ready to date on your terms? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
Hello, everyone. Here is another episode of All My Best Friends Are Digital. I'm one of your hosts, Caitlin Bailey, and with me, I have Mark Bigney. Mark, how are you doing?
I'm very well. I've noticed that the past couple of weeks we've neglected our tagline. Do we need a new tagline? Are you negging the tagline?
Oh, no, I am totally not negging the tagline. I just forgot to say it.
Branding is important. I think we need proper branding. That is why I have All My Best Friends Are Digital, a podcast about video games and the stories they tell, tattooed on my forehead. It's a good look.
Awesome. Maybe I should also get it tattooed on my forehead, and then I will remember to say it.
If we both have it tattooed on our forehead, then it would look awkward. It would look like we were trying to arrange things at social gatherings. It would just look bad, so
fair
perhaps
enough.
Best not.
So today, we are going to be starting with the games we've been playing lately, as always. Then we are going to talk about the retro game Psychonauts in our Gaming Opinions on Old School Funware segment, aka Goof. And then we're going to talk about our feature game, Blueprints. Blueprints. Get it? Blueprints?
It took me an embarrassingly long time to make that connection.
Me too. Don't worry. then we're going to wrap it up with shameless hyping of upcoming titles, aka Shout. It's going to be great. So Mark, what have you been playing lately?
After lamenting that I didn't have a gameplay partner with whom to play It Takes Two or Split Fiction, a dear friend of mine, my platonic life partner, Josephus, reached out and said he would be willing to throw down. And in point of fact, I also decided to reach out to my friend TechDweeb to see if he wanted to play such games, and I got a yes from both. So, ooh. I'm playing It Takes Two with Josephus, and I'm playing Split Fiction with TechDweeb. I don't have enough of a grounding in Split Fiction to yet comment, but I've played a fair bit more with Josephus when playing It Takes Two. So, you talked a bit about this a couple weeks ago. These are two-player-only games by Hazelight. They started off... The initial sort of proof of concept early version was 2013's Brothers, A Tale of Two Sons, which everyone seems to have exhausted the national stocks of Kleenex by weeping hysterically. I didn't really finish Brothers. It didn't really vibe with me. And then they formalized it actually with Hazelight in 2018 with A Way Out, a prison break game. And then It Takes Two in 2021, and this year's 2025 Split Fiction. So I haven't played A Way Out. It Takes Two was my first experience with the Hazelight formula. Mm-hmm. And in hindsight, I should have realized that I was already primed for it because I've commented even on this show while playing games like Resident Evil 4 that I really like the dynamic where one character can go places the other one can't, and then they hit the switch so the other character can go through. And I even enjoy this dynamic when the other character is AI controlled or just an NPC. Prince of Persia, Sands of Time does this, as well as The Two Thrones, and I just enjoy the dynamic, and when the other character is an actual human player, that makes it all the better. I was getting very strong flashbacks to about 20 years ago because of the split-screen action. It has been so long
yes.
Since I've actually seen a literal split screen, this is true whether you play locally or remotely, you literally have a split screen. It's wild. It was such a throwback. And the mechanical innovation on display, it is just a relentless series of set pieces that are either just viscerally engaging thrill ride sequences, like here, grind down this rail for like 5 minutes and jump from rail to rail because there's a spark in your way or a wall or something, and just a relentless series of new gameplay mechanisms that are very simple, but rely on cooperation with your partner, and they're constantly switching up. It is so fun to play. It Takes Two, and so far the dynamics of Split Fiction are the same, but I'll talk more about that later. What I was unprepared for was how successful the sort of thrill ride slash set piece dynamics were, because a number of other games have tried to do this and failed. I mean, it might seem to be a simple formula, a sort of relentlessly crowd-pleasing, almost fan fiction-esque desire to have constant engagement and new interesting things happen. I call to mind my initial reaction to Resident Evil 6. I had about half a minute of like, oh, they're really just throwing everything at the wall and doing lots of weird different stuff. Okay, that's cool. And about 5 minutes later, I was like, nah, this isn't working on board. But It Takes Two pulls it off. It's really fun to play. Very simple control schemes. All the gimmicks are very simple and straightforward, but they're cute gimmicks and fun to play with. So an example, very early on in the game, you start off with a double jump and a dash, and you're just wandering around double jumping and dashing. And then you get an anthropomorphic hammerhead and an anthropomorphic set of nails. And so one character could throw nails, and one character's got the hammer. And so one character would throw a nail somewhere, and the one with the hammer can then use the claw head of the hammer to swing off the nail. Reasonably straightforward. Nothing, again, mind-breaking, but very often you get those moments of cooperation where one player is like, I think what you need to do is use your nail over there, and then I could get to this new area. And it's like, oh, okay. And then you go and do the cooperation. What I wasn't prepared for, Caitlin, was how borderline offensively stupid the writing is. It's some of the worst writing I've ever seen in my life, frankly. And the jarring, the incredibly jarring difference between the game design quality and the quality of the writing, and indeed even just the execution. It's a slickly designed game. It's well produced. The voice acting is well done, and the graphics are well done. Even just the cinematography, for lack of a better word, is well done in terms of the presentation of cutscenes and so forth. But the writing and the characterization makes me feel like a dumber, worse human being while I'm being subjected to it.
Oh no!
Let me just give you an example of how bad it is, and then I'll talk more broadly about the themes that it introduces that make me feel like I'm actually getting worse as a human being, not just as a video gamer while playing It Takes Two. There was a sequence while I was playing with Josephus where, you know how sometimes, and I've even done this on the show, you make a joke just because it's the most awful joke you can think of, and you're kind of appalled at how bad the joke is, and so you feel the need to say it.
Sure.
Are you familiar with this dynamic?
Extremely.
So I did that in It Takes Two, and then not 2 minutes later, one of the characters in the game makes the exact same joke. And I felt like, I don't know what I felt like, but it almost moved me to self-harm, Caitlin. It was the overall themes of It Takes Two, I think, are best characterized by the vibe of like a turn-of-the-century detergent commercial, right? So imagine the scene. This could be for detergent. This could be for washing machine fluid. This could be for a vacuum. This could be for a mop. Could be for almost any domestic kind of thing. But this is the vibe of the commercial. We've all seen this marketing. Useless bumbling husband doesn't know how to do the thing. Look how pathetic and stupid the large man-child is.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, man-child husband is married to shrew wife, who knows everything and won't let stupid husband forget it. And so you see these two contemptible people locked in a relationship of mutual disdain and verbal abuse. And this is the sort of dynamic used to push domestic products. It is also the fundamental dynamic of the two main characters of It Takes Two. Have I been, according to your impressions, uncharitable?
No. Over time, I guess the story, the characters grew on me more, but especially early on, it was bad. It was dark.
Dark is a good word, because these people So the overall thrust of the plot of the game is this couple is contemplating a divorce, to which I think, look, I'm not pro-divorce by any stretch of the imagination, but it seems like a pretty good recourse given how much they seem to loathe each other, and quite frankly, how much I think neither of them deserves to be in, or is suited to be in a long-term romantic relationship. So their child, though, is very, very sad at this prospect, which is understandable. And what comes to the rescue, and I use this term advisedly, because, yeah, the structure of the game is it's even obvious from the title of the game itself. Obviously, they're going to learn to put aside their differences, blah, 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 blah. The sort of vehicle or mechanism by which they do this is this talking book named Professor Hakim. Now, when I heard that his name was Professor Hakim, and I'd already seen the poor quality of writing and characterization and presentation of It Takes Two, I was very concerned that this was going to be some incredibly reductive Arab stereotype. Fortunately, I didn't have anything to worry about, because instead it's an incredibly reductive Mexican stereotype, or some other Spanish-speaking person. It's so bad, Caitlin.
Yeah.
It's really quite awful. Frankly, I'm shocked that it doesn't get more critical attention. Again, this is kind of like the situation of Red Dead Redemption 2, where it's like, oh, yeah. I had a lot to recommend it. I can totally see it. Why isn't anyone talking about how bad the controls are? Similarly, when playing It Takes Two, I have no difficulty understanding why everyone was raving about it, and it gets all these plaudits and awards. It was nominated for a story award, Caitlin. In one of the video game award shows, they nominated it for narrative. And I'm like, okay, fine. I guess, but doesn't narrative have at least some notional contact with the characters involved? And all of them are terrible. It's so bad. The only way I'm able to get through it is, number one, making fun of them with Josephus. Mm-hmm. And number two, knowing that it's only a matter of time before I get to the next fun gameplay element. Now, I'm sure they get better. I'm only about halfway through, by some reckoning. These are games of relatively substantial length. They kind of earn the length by constantly mixing things up and giving you new gimmicks to play around with. But, oh my goodness, you can do this story without starting them out as loathsome, contemptible stereotypes.
Yeah, the fact that the two main characters seem to absolutely hate each other, plus this incredibly irritating book about love, like, that is not a good, that's not a good mixture.
I keep expecting Speedy Gonzalez from the 60s cartoons to enter from stage left and pull aside Dr. Hakim and say, dude, you're making us look bad. Could you tone down the accent a little bit?
Oh, no.
Could you try to sound like a, come on, guy. It's grating, and it's juvenile, and I don't know how this made it past the editing room floor. It's so bad.
But the gameplay's good. Yay.
Why didn't you warn me, Caitlin?
I don't know, because it's been a long time, and the gameplay was so fun that it overrode the downsides to me.
I have to say, very early reports, the characters in Split Fiction aren't nearly as bad. They're still pretty bad.
Yeah, so they also grew on me a lot, but I don't feel like they were nearly as bad as as the It Takes Two characters.
There is tons of room, however, between the awfulness of the It Takes Two protagonists all the way to the Split Fiction protagonists, but there's still so much more room before we get to tolerable.
Yes. Yeah, I hear you there. I actually, though, I do think they get tolerable through the course of the game. Of Split Fiction.
I would hope so. Yes. As I say, I'm much earlier in Split Fiction. It is truly, as you say, a testament to the quality of the gameplay that I am willing to suffer through these borderline monsters.
Yeah, it's worth it.
Sure, sure. It's a whole scene. It's a whole scene. All right, Caitlin, what have you been up to lately?
I spent most of the week playing Blueprints. But I also spent a few hours playing Final Fantasy IV. I'm almost done. I don't have too much to say about that, except that it drives me absolutely crazy how I can res somebody in a fight, and within a fraction of a second, they get meleeed and are dead again. And it's like, how? How did that happen? Why is this happening? So annoying. But more importantly, I decided to try out the game Repo, which is R-E-P-O. I played it with my friend Kate. So REPO stands for the Retrieve, Extract, and Profit Operation. And it's an online co-op horror game in the vein of Lethal Company. So the gist is that you and up to, I think, 4 or 5 of your friends get sent into a kind of scary environment, like a haunted house or, you know, an abandoned magic school or something like that. And you need to collect a certain amount of treasure. There's like a threshold of treasure that you need to collect, you know, the amount that it's worth that you need to collect. So you need to bring it back to this thing that kind of zoops it all up and it gives you money. And meanwhile, there's monsters and other terrible things in the house that are going to try to kill you and or destroy your stuff. So I was introduced to this by a streamer called Gabs, I think her name is. She had an absolutely delightful stream of playing REPO with her friends. And I was like, okay, you know what? I'm doing this and we're going to have fun. And I have to say, Steam Deck, really not an ideal choice, but I didn't have any other options since I was away from my PC. It really doesn't play very well on the Steam Deck right now because there's no official controller configuration.
Ooh.
So it was a little rough, but it was worth it to just, you know, try it out, mess around a bit. There's also proximity-based voice chat, which didn't really do anything for us because we were in the same room together. But I think that would be really cool, just like in Lethal Company. But it would be really cool if you're actually playing in separate houses. And then on top of that, there's no native field of view slider. So I was super motion sick by the time we were done.
Oh, no.
But there's mods. So now that I'm home, I'm really excited to, you know, give REPO a try with mods, including a field of view mod. I loved Lethal Company. I initially played that with my like Tuesday night gaming group, and that was really fun. So I think REPO is going to be great. In REPO, everybody is like these cute little, like, kind of capsule-shaped robot guys. And when the players look around, you can watch their character kind of look around. When they talk, they kind of open their mouths. This is going to date me, probably. But it reminds me of the Canadian characters in South Park, how, like, the whole, like, upper half of their head just, like, moves. That's kind of how the robots talk.
That's exactly what I was going to say, yeah. It looks exactly like how the Canadians talk in South Park.
Yeah. But, yeah, it's just really adorable. The monsters are kind of scary. I don't know how to deal with all of them yet, but it was very fun despite all of the issues that I experienced while playing. It is, of course, also early access, so we'll see where it goes. But it was very fun.
When you say horror, that conjures to mind a certain tone. And then you see the gameplay footage of REPO, and it is very much horror comedy rather than
yes.
horror frightening.
Yeah. The stuff that I think is really cool about it is that you can actually hide, unlike some of the games, some of the other kind of like co-op horror, like extract stuff games that I've played before. So I really like that. And then the other part is that there's physics. You have like a little kind of gravity gun thing that you can use to pick items up. But if you slam them into the wall or the floor, you can break them, and they'll lose value if you bang them against things. So it adds like a new aspect to everything. Like you don't just pick up everything and walk it back to the ship. You have to like very carefully either place it in your cart or carry it all the way back to the extraction area without hitting something or getting scared by a monster and dropping it. And it looks neat.
So just out of curiosity, when a monster starts aggressing you.
Yeah.
I assume it's not the kind of game where you then pull out your Desert Eagle, confront the monster, and put it to rest. Like, is it that flight is the only option? Is it the case that when a monster has caught you, you're already basically toast? What's the deal?
So it varies a bit. Early on, so you don't start with any weapons. You can buy some traps. I think there's some mines that you can get, maybe grenades. We never spent money on any of those, so I don't know how those work really. But for the most part, some of the enemies we found were rather deadly. Others, not so deadly, but they could do things that would. So one of them is like this little barf monster that like possesses you and makes you throw up, and I assume that also makes noise and can attract other monsters to you and make them find you if you're hiding. So at least early game, mostly you can just hide. And you have to try to kind of sneak around, make sure that the enemies can't find you. there's this one monster that, like, gets mad when it can't get through something. So we accidentally left our cart in a doorway, and it just stood in the doorway screaming and breaking all of our stuff in the cart. So we watched, like, you know, $13,000 worth of stuff just dwindle down to nothing. It was very sad. But yeah, that's Repo.
Cool. I take it that the stream was sufficiently compelling that you were willing to break your general policy against fake games, as we call early access games.
Yeah, it also helped that it was only $10. So I was like, you know what? $10, I can do that.
You're not made of stone.
Yeah. And they were so cute with their weird little heads just opening to talk. It was too much.
They are awfully cute, yes. The aesthetic is different, but the vibe kind of reminds me of Among Us.
Yeah.
Where you have this very, very cute aesthetic and, like, little stubby things wandering around, coupled with this very, very grim theme of violence and terror.
Yeah, I totally agree. Very, very similar to Among Us in some ways.
All right, glad you're enjoying Repo. And no doubt we'll be hearing more about Final Fantasy IV as time goes on.
Yeah.
So we now move on to some gaming opinions on old school funware, what we call goof. This time we're going to be talking about Psychonauts, which was originally published on the PlayStation 2 in 2005. There were some ports. Double Fine Production eventually got the rights back to the game from Majesco because in some ways Psychonauts contributed to the bankruptcy of Majesco. And it was remastered in 2012 and is now available almost everywhere. And then leading to the sequel not too long ago, which is an impressive 15 plus years between Psychonauts 1 and Psychonauts 2. This is by the famous Tim Schafer of Double Fine Productions. We talked a little bit about Tim Schafer earlier on when we talked about Grim Fandango remastered not too long ago. Caitlin, my understanding is that you played the remastered version on PC.
I did, yes.
Whereas I played the PlayStation 2 original, albeit with improved textures and widescreen hacks, because you can make anything a remaster with emulation.
Nice.
So why don't you tell us what's going on in Psychonauts, Caitlin?
Okay, so in Psychonauts, you play as this kid named Rasputin, aka Raz. He is a young boy with psychic abilities, and he sneaks into a summer camp for other kids with similar abilities, and he has ambitions to become a Psychonaut. The camp's like, no, you're not actually supposed to be here, but while you wait for your parents to come pick you up, I guess you can do this basic braining course that we have going. Thus starts the game. So Psychonauts is something that my friend Tony recommended to me years and years ago, easily 20 years ago, which is a little scary to think of. I bought it for PS2, and then I never got around to playing it. So this time around, as Mark said, I played the remastered version on Steam. I was traveling, just had my Steam Deck, so I played it on that. Side note, don't recommend that. Please don't play it on your Steam Deck because the controller support, there's a official controller layout, quote, I'm doing air quotes right now, but the camera just spins in circles the whole time. So I had to do a bunch of tweaking to get it to work. It was very annoying. So it'll just play better on PC.
You had serious camera problems with Call of Juarez Gunslinger. Are you sure that your sticks on your Steam Deck work?
So yes, I actually looked this up because I was like, man, this is the second game that I'm having trouble with.
Okay,
and
sure.
It is a widespread problem, apparently.
Oh, that's so strange. It's weird. I have a number of handheld PCs that are designed for gaming.
Yeah.
I had a Steam Deck briefly. I then sold it because it was a limited edition one, and I do not like the Steam Deck. But I'm amazed at the number of Steam games. See, the reason why I don't really like the Steam Deck, among other things, is I do a lot of gaming on Game Pass. I do a lot of gaming on GOG. I do a lot of gaming on the EA free games. And your SOL on the Steam Deck for all of those things.
Mm-hmm.
And I also just like some of the gimmicks that are available in other games. Like the Lenovo Legion Go, I love all the gimmicks in the Legion Go. Oh, it makes me so happy. And I've got massive hands, so the fact that it's a console designed for massive hands is okay. But anyway, setting all that aside... But I'm amazed at the number of Steam things on Steam that don't work properly on the Steam Deck, which boggles the mind, because they have even ones with good controller support, with like a good Xbox default controller, don't seem to work properly on the Steam Deck. That's so weird. Anyway, I know there are legions of people that love the Steam Deck.
Yeah.
My boy Tech Dweeb adores the Steam Deck. That's fine. I'm not trying to yuck your yum. People can like what they want to like. It's just, as somebody who's not accustomed to the Steam Deck architecture, I'm amazed at how porous it seems to be in some ways.
Yeah. I have not had any issues with newer games on the Steam Deck, but
sure.
Both Call of Juarez and Psychonauts are fairly old. Call of Juarez was 2013, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah, about a year after the remaster, yeah. So,
yeah, it feels like something's up with games from that era, perhaps.
Which is more understandable, sure.
Yeah. That said, I'm sure they work nicely on your hardware.
I was actually playing this on my Retroid Pocket Flip 2.
Mm.
Because, as I say, I was emulating the PlayStation 2. I don't tend to do much emulation on Windows machines. It's just they're not well suited to that.
Sure.
Because of battery life issues, and it's like using an elephant gun to kill a fly. So I'm more than happy to use various Android gizmos that I also have. Actually, I think I shouted out the Retroid Pocket Flip 2 not too long ago. It has arrived, and I can testify that it is A, glorious, and B, hideously ugly. It is among the most ugly devices I've ever acquired. Fortunately, it's a clamshell, though, so all you have to do is flip it open, and then it's less ugly, because it's so hideous. It's wild. Anyway,
awesome.
But Psychonauts emulates beautifully on devices running any kind of relatively recent Snapdragon processor, so it all works fine on the Flip 2.
Good.
I do like the sort of high and low stakes juxtaposed with which Psychonauts begins, because it literally is the case that there's this summer camp for psychic operatives, and Raz doesn't belong there. And it's like, okay, your parents are going to come to get you in a couple days, but I guess you might as well do training in the meantime. He's like, all right, all I have to do is pass all the certifications before I get picked up because I don't belong here.
Yeah.
And it's a really glorious kind of Saturday morning cartoon setup. It then spirals into bigger things, right? It doesn't culminate quite in like a Final Fantasy ending. It's not quite about some sort of primeval entity that comes to threaten the world, but the stakes do get higher. I just love this idea that the camp counselors, their response is basically just a shrug. You'd be like, I guess you sure, while you're here, why not?
Yeah.
It's kind of cool. And this is a minor tonal element. I also just kind of appreciate how the adults are rendered in this Saturday morning cartoon setup. Because most of the time, they would be rendered as like either completely toothless or utterly indifferent to their charges. But as it is, despite the fact that the world is very wacky and there's a lot of slapstick and over-the-top humor and sometimes even just like sort of childlike, not childish, but childlike humor, they're relatively grounded in the sense that they recognize that they're in charge of children. But at the same time, they happen to be training psychic operatives. So even the one that's hilariously obsessed with war tropes and war movies is not completely hostile to the survival of his charges. Anyway, yeah. I just thought that was a nice tonal touch that differentiated it from a lot of other stories that seek to maintain the same tone.
Yeah, I completely agree. Okay, so the gameplay of Psychonauts.
Oh, but things were going so well. Why did we have to get to that? I wanted to be happy for a few more minutes, but okay, let's talk about the gameplay.
Sorry. So you end up entering kind of like the mindscape of other characters. And the first one you jump into is Coach Oleander, the aforementioned kind of war / soldier obsessed guy. And it ends up, you're literally on a battlefield. There's missiles coming from everywhere. And, you know, it's kind of scary, honestly. There's lots of warplanes just flying around. And the gist is that you have to collect figments, which are these kind of 2D drawn characters or items that are spread throughout the world. And by collecting those scattered around the brainscape, you will level up your psychic power.
You also get to encounter mental baggage.
Yes.
Which is literal pieces of luggage for which you have to acquire tags. And then pick up the bag, and then they all get... They're little anthropomorphic pieces of luggage.
Yes.
It's kind of ridiculous. The brain and mental-related puns are relentless, and I kind of enjoyed them.
Yeah, I love how, like, on theme everything was. Yeah, the baggage was great.
It is a well-fleshed-out world. Again, it's childlike, but seldom childish.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I would characterize it is this is the best Saturday morning cartoon that never existed. Like, even just the way characters are presented, every character has exaggerated proportions, but still looks vaguely human. Mm-hmm. The one kind of exception, though, that almost goes too far, but I still like the design, is the bully amongst the children. He has this mop of curly hair and this crooked set of teeth, and the curly hair is this huge, almost coral-like extension that proceeds in a weird, lumpy globe from his head. It's kind of hideous, but that's the point.
Yeah, his hair is a lot, and it comes up frequently in conversation.
But we were talking about the gameplay. I keep getting distracted by talking about how great the world is, and you want us to talk about the game. What did you want to say about the gameplay?
Oh, just, you know, so it's mostly platforming. You have to jump around, collect these figments, make your way through this brainscape in order to get to the end. The camera is some typical early 2000s nonsense. I really hated it. It was really bad.
It's really bad, yeah. One of my favorite games is a platformer of the same era. Again, Prince of Persia, Sands of Time.
Yeah.
Roughly the same time. You spend a lot of time with the right stick massaging the camera, but it feels a lot better than the camera and than Psychonauts. Because the camera in Psychonauts does all those things. It gets hung up on platforms. It goes behind walls. Mm-hmm. It's all the... You never quite feel like you're pointed the right way. It doesn't do any effort to have the camera pointed where you might want to be going. It's a whole scene.
It is definitely a whole scene. I thought the platforming was fine. I didn't mind it too much.
I did.
For me, the worst parts of the platforming were when it switched between a fixed camera and the free camera. So I'd be like trying to do a jump from fixed camera area, and then it becomes free camera. As I'm jumping, I'm like, oh no, I'm not aimed the right way. And then I fall and die and have to start it over.
I didn't notice that as a particularly added burden to the managing the camera. I just felt that the entire platforming elements seemed loose and sloppy. Mm-hmm. Like everything feels kind of slippery.
Yes.
And when you were talking about transitions, I thought you were going to be talking about transitions like between a ladder or to a pole or to swinging from something. Like there's a sort of balance. The way and Psychonauts really drove this home for me. There's a kind of balance between platforming being too loose and too tight. Mm-hmm. When it's too loose and you're never really sure where you're going to go, you're never quite sure if you're going to grab that ledge, you're never quite sure whether that netting, whether the game is going to think that you've hit the netting at the right angle so that you start climbing on it, or if you're just going to tumble to the very bottom of the level. Or it can be too tight, and then you just feel like you're on autopilot. At that point, you just feel like you're doing like the parkour in some of your more modern Assassin's Creed games, for example, where when the series started, you actually were controlling climbing to a certain extent, but now you just push a direction and your little free runner goes in that direction. You don't have any further inputs, right? And I definitely think that Psychonauts is way too loose. Like, I just could not figure out how to get my little Raz to reliably latch onto the things that the game wanted me to latch onto.
Mm.
And again, perhaps an unfair comparison, when you compare it to the contemporaneous Prince of Persia games, where I felt like the balance was just about perfect. This is the thing we talk about a lot in the context of platforming, reliability. You should understand when you miss a jump, why you missed the jump, or when you miss a connection, why you missed the connection, and not think that it's because of some mysterious special sauce going on under the hood, and the game just doesn't want to let you get away with or trigger the thing in quite the right way. Psychonauts, I often felt that was what was going on. I just couldn't get on the same level with it.
Yeah, I actually can see that. So when I played on the Steam Deck especially, there was this one section where there were a whole bunch of poles that I had to swing from lower to jump up higher, and I kept missing, and I was losing my mind. It was very, very frustrating. I had a much easier time when I actually switched over to the computer. And I don't know if that's controller stuff or what, but that was incredibly frustrating. Like, that was just not a good platforming section.
I think I know the sequence to which you're referring, and it didn't feel great for me either. And the lock-on feature is very clumsy, I find. You eventually get a ranged weapon. I actually feel that Psychonauts does a reasonably good job of introducing new techniques as you go on. I mean, it's thematically appropriate. You're literally picking up these merit badges as you go along. It's like, okay, now children, today we're teaching you how to set things on fire with pyrokinesis. Yay! Here's your pyrokinesis merit badge. Okay, fine. And the tutorials are relatively snappy. So sure, I don't feel like they're condescending to me or wasting my time. But not all the new mechanisms feel very smooth. Mm-hmm. And in particular, I find the lock-on element for ranged combat, that when it will decide to lock on and when it won't decide to lock on seems very picky.
Okay, yeah. Sadly, I did not have as much time to play Psychonauts as I wanted to, so I did not get to that part. I basically finished basic braining. I was about to go to the next area, and then I had to get on the plane.
It was at the end of basic braining that the charm started to go off the title as a whole. Like, I was still, I love the world of Psychonauts. Mm-hmm. I love inhabiting the world. I love watching those characters talk. I like hearing, I'm even willing to hear the asides of like the secondary or tertiary camp characters that I don't really care about all that much. We'll get to Dogen in a second because Dogen deserves an award, and I think he deserves his own series of games because Dogen is the best. I would die for Dogen. He's amazing. but it was after basic braining where I'm like, this doesn't feel very tight. In particular, I had jumped up underneath a platform one too many times. I don't know if you're familiar with this sensation in 3D platformers where, or even in 2D platformers where you jump and your head bumps up underneath the platform you need to go.
Yeah.
I hate that. I do that all the time in Psychonauts. And then they start introducing more mechanisms, and none of them feel very smooth.
Mm-hmm.
And none of them feel very good. And as the levels went on, I felt like I was less experiencing the world and more playing with the mechanisms that they'd built in their little toolbox. And that is not Psychonauts at its best.
Yeah.
So who's your favorite character and why is he Dogen?
Dogen... So actually, when you were talking about the character design and how, you know, certain things tend to be very overemphasized, but one maybe didn't look particularly human, I almost thought you were going to talk about Dogen because he's like an egg with feet.
Yeah, he's got these tiny beady eyes that are directly on the opposite sides of his skull.
Yeah.
Kind of like a fish. He looks a little bit like a fish to me, or some versions of fish.
Yeah.
So Dogen is a small child wearing footy pajamas and a tinfoil hat. And it is explained very early on. He explains in his adorable voice that he doesn't really blow people's heads up. Well, except for maybe that one time. But that doesn't happen anymore now that he's got his hat.
Yeah.
And the main character is like, okay, that's kind of cool. And then they, you know, toddle off and Dogen's going to his bunk. And Dogen says, you want to try on my hat? No. And at that point, I was fully won over.
Yeah.
I was won over by the world. I was won over by Dogen. And it was just great. And I seldom laugh out loud in the context of playing games, but I definitely laughed at that moment. And anytime Dogen is on screen, he definitely steals the show.
He absolutely does. I love that weird little guy. I mean, the first time you see him after the intro, he's being harassed by squirrels. And it doesn't go so well for the squirrels.
Yeah, he can talk to squirrels.
Yeah.
Apparently they're harassing him. They won't leave him alone. He feels a sense of persecution. And yeah, it doesn't end well for the squirrels.
No. Yeah, Raz wanders away, turns around, and all the squirrels are suddenly missing. It's like, oh, that's weird. And then their little bodies fall from the sky.
Yeah, raining squirrel parts.
Terrible.
They had it coming to them. I'm on Dogen's side.
They definitely had it coming. Dogen can do no wrong.
So I definitely was left with the impression, playing a fair bit of both It Takes Two and Psychonauts over the course of the past few days, if we could get the gameplay of It Takes Two and the overall writing and charm of Psychonauts, because in some ways, they've got similar kinds of vibes, a very cartoonish kind of surreality to them,
mm-hmm.
right? There's this juxtaposition of the mundane and the bizarre and the fantastical. And so if we could get Tim Schafer to write for Hazelight, I think we'd have something truly spectacular. Because, as I say, I like the world of Psychonauts. I even like inhabiting the world of Psychonauts. But all too often, once the actual levels start, I don't feel like I'm inhabiting the world. I just feel like I'm wrestling with a game.
Yeah, I'm very curious. So I'd never played Psychonauts, as I mentioned. And I also have never played Psychonauts 2. I'm wondering if Psychonauts 2 suffers from the same stuff or not.
I'm increasingly of the opinion that maybe Tim Schafer and I aren't on the same wavelength, mm-hmm. because I often like a lot of the charm and a lot of the worlds that he designs. But when it comes time to interact with those worlds, I don't feel like it's working very well. I felt kind of the same way about Elements of Grim Fandango, but then again, Grim Fandango is just a textbook instantiation of a, at the time, well-worn genre that is very much not to my liking.
Yeah.
But now that Psychonauts moves into, you know, if you had to classify it as a genre, I think platformer is kind of accurate. If you wouldn't call it a platformer, you'd have to apply the incredibly muddy action-adventure application, which effectively means less than nothing.
Yeah. Every game, almost.
Yeah, I like platformers. By 2005, they had kind of figured out how to do 3D platforming pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And Psychonauts is not a good example of this.
All right, so that was Psychonauts, and now we are going to take a quick break for some ads.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/listen. That's forhers.com/listen. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies based on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Ugh, spam calls. Sound familiar? Introducing Line 2. Get a second phone number right on your existing phone. Imagine discounts, appointments, online forms. Handle it all without giving out your personal number. It's like having a secret weapon against spam. And when those unwanted calls sneak through, boom, blocked. No more interruptions, no more stress. Stay connected, stay protected. Keep your main number safe and out of harm's way. Ready to take back your phone? Visit line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in the App Store today.
And we're back. Coming up next is our feature title, Blueprints. It was released earlier in April this year, developed by Dogubom.
Is that how you say it?
I have no idea. I don't know.
Dogubom, I guess, is good at Dogubom, Dogubom, I don't know.
Yeah, no idea. Mark, why don't you tell us a little bit about Blueprints?
Blueprints is a puzzle roguelite slash roguelite game. If anything, it's kind of similar to a roguelite in that it's basically a tile-based game where you move by tiles anyway. So I'm willing to say that in this case, the pedantic distinction that I insist on is largely irrelevant. The story is that you are kind of sort of the eponymous Blueprints, I guess, although mostly it was designed as a pun. Your uncle died without any other heirs and leaves you an estate, kind of. You only get the estate if you find the 46th room. This is harder than you might think because, number one, there's only room for 45 rooms, and the estate shifts from day to day. You're told that once you find the 46th room, the estate's yours. I don't know who would want a nightmarish house like this, but whatever. In today's economy, I guess you take what you can get.
Yeah.
I don't know how you insure such a property, but anyway. And what proceeds is a sort of drafting game slash puzzle where you're in a grid of rooms, you move from room to room, you have a certain limited move allowance every day. Some rooms mess with that, giving you more or less. And whenever you go through a door, you're presented with an option of three-ish rooms that can then slot on the other side. Sometimes those rooms have puzzles. Sometimes those rooms contribute to puzzles. Sometimes those rooms don't do anything at all. I wouldn't know which one is which because it's a puzzle game, and I was very quickly in over my head. And most of the time, you end up in a situation, in my experience anyway, and in the experience of the people I've talked to, you end up in a situation where the game doesn't let you proceed because you end up with a series of dead ends because of what you were able to draft.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you enter a room and you're like, okay, I need there to be an extra exit somewhere. Oh, they're all dead end rooms. Oh, great. Okay, back up, go to the next one, lead to a dead end. There you go. Oh, but I've still got 23 moves left today. Tough noogies. Time to call it a day. Start again tomorrow. And so on and so forth. There are limited areas of meta progression. It is, after all, a roguelike structure. And puzzles abound.
Yeah, that about sums it up.
So what's been your experience with Blueprints?
So, all right. I want to start with the downsides, because I actually have to say, I think the Blueprints is brilliant, and I loved it. And I was very surprised. And none of these things completely tanked my opinion, but they're there anyway. So,
sock it to me.
This Blueprints felt like a game that didn't always respect your time.
Yes.
There were loads of unskippable, repetitive sequences, like the New Day sequence, when you have to dig holes. There's one point where you unlock something, and if you want to go use this thing that you unlocked, you have to travel there every single day. And it's not a long walk, but it's not a short walk either. So it kind of sucks.
Why didn't you just use the run feature and walk at like 120% of your walking speed?
Oh, so annoying.
At least the solid music would keep you entertained while you were going from point A to point B, right?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. There's hardly ever any music. And when there is music, it's mostly just tones.
Yeah. Yeah. I honestly thought that Blueprints would have music. Like, to a... I was surprised.
You mean like how most games do? Sure.
Yes. I was very surprised by the lack of music, because I thought, like, you know, if you're going to be doing all this stuff, you might as well, like, be vibing to something that sounds nice. But no. You can't exit and save in the middle of a run. I played most of it on Steam Deck, again, on vacation. So it wasn't too bad for me. I could just put the Steam Deck to sleep, pick it up later, and be fine. If I'd been playing on my PC, though, that would have been super annoying. Like, either you have... force it to minimize and you do other stuff, but you can't really play other games because you're already running a game, and yeah, that's a mess. The inability to just stop and save, like, you're forced to end the day if you want to stop the game. It's really weird. I was surprised that there wasn't kind of like a in-game journal for note-taking or any way to collect notes. I ended up taking a lot of screenshots, but then I would have to sort through all those screenshots on my Steam Deck, and it was a huge pain.
The game actually tells you in Blueprints, oh, by the way, you might want to start a physical journal and take notes.
Yeah.
To which my response was, what is this, 1983?
Yeah. I also discovered that I didn't have a pen and paper in the hotel room. So thankfully, like, I had a tablet. So I have like a drawing program. So I opened that up and I used that to take a few notes, but it just... That still felt very silly to me.
A minor thing that's somewhat related that bothered me was that the map feature doesn't tell you which doors are locked.
Yes, that would have been so helpful. Because the number of times I walk up, I'm like, okay, that's locked. Let me go find this other door on the other side of the map that isn't hopefully locked. Okay, so I get through there, but then the next door is locked. But then I don't remember that first door that I hit 7 rooms ago was locked, and I go all the way back only to find out that I can't do anything. Yeah, it was. So that was really annoying. I think that covers my downsides. Do you have anything you wanted to add?
Okay, well, I have a question that kind of dovetails with my crack about the absence of music.
Yeah.
I confess I was expecting Blueprints to be a lot more atmospheric than it was.
Mm-hmm.
Because something about the setup and the conceit of the game made me think that it was going to be stylish and at least good at conveying a vibe or a mood, either in terms of the visuals or the sounds or both. And I confess, I didn't really get much of either. And that kind of accentuated the sense that I was just very slowly working my way through uninteresting rooms much of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Was that your reaction as well?
So I didn't worry too much about that, but I agree that that was the feeling for quite a bit of it. Just feeling like, you know,
okay.
It didn't have a lot of personality. It was just like, okay, here's a room. It has, like, I'm going to scan across, try to see if there's any items on the floor. No, there's not. Okay, we're moving on. There wasn't a whole lot of, like, really lovely set pieces to explore. There wasn't a lot of exploring in general, other than the fact that, of course, you go into new rooms. You know, you can kind of see everything right away. Hopefully you manage to pick out any items that happened to be lying there. I'm sure I missed some, just because that's how it is.
So what's all the good stuff you loved?
Okay, so I was pleasantly surprised by Blueprints. Okay, so I'm going to say something ridiculous, because then I'm going to walk it back immediately. I thought it would be significantly more puzzly. It actually is significantly more puzzly in some ways. But I guess what I liked is that you don't have to solve some overcomplicated puzzle in every single room just to be able to progress to the next room.
Right.
So I think that the pacing of getting through the rooms generally can be pretty good. I really liked how it mixed the roguelite mechanics with like strategy and problem solving and puzzles. I think I came across a book in the game at some point in Blueprints that told me all about different strategies for getting through more and more of the house. Because I was getting to the point where I would probably get, 20 some odd rooms, and I'd end up, you know, either out of resources or all dead ends. And some of the suggestions are like, make sure you explore the like lower floors, like basically like the first row of floors, the south part of the house, fully before you progress too far. Because if you, you know, just do a straight shot for the top of the house, you're going to end up locking yourself out of a lot of stuff. You might run out of resources. So yeah, don't do that. Take it slow. And those all really helped. I was surprised by how helpful some, you know, just regular old in-game hints were. And the puzzles, with a couple exceptions, they didn't seem too hard. Most of them felt kind of natural. That said, actually, I it's hard to even say that because I have finished Blueprints, technically-ish. I made it to room 46, let's put it that way. There's still a ton of other puzzles in Blueprints that I'm sure I haven't even discovered. Never mind, actually, you know, started on or started to figure out. So there's probably loads of stuff that's just completely over my head right now. But at least getting to room 46, there was only one puzzle that I ended up overthinking, honestly, and I wasn't able to solve without actually looking it up.
When starting a new roguelike, I naturally assume that what is stated to be the victory end condition is not the victory end condition.
Yeah.
And that is just the first time you kind of successfully complete a run. Like, few games take it to the absurd extent that Hades did. It was like, oh, congratulations, you killed Hades. You're a third of the way through the game.
Yeah.
But most roguelikes, like, I've still been playing a lot more of Rogue Loops,
mm-hmm.
right? And sure enough, you kill the final boss, and he basically says, nice try, but your princess is in another castle, and that's just the way of things.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Is there a mushroom in room 46 who says, nice try, but the princess is in another room?
Not quite, but
okay.
But it's very clear by the time you get there that there are other mysteries that you can solve.
Right.
But yeah, I guess Blueprints was fun and rewarding in a way that I don't usually find puzzle games to be. And one thing I also liked, and honestly, like, you could probably somewhat call this cheating, but I really enjoyed the kind of co-op aspect of playing it that I had playing Blueprints at the same time as my husband, because we would tell each other, you know, some of the stuff that we discovered.
Oh, sure.
And it was fun to figure some stuff out together like that.
Yeah, my wife is playing Blueprints. She is thoroughly enjoying it. And yeah, we've talked about, have you found room X? What did you make of room Y? And I was actually, I'm very shocked to discover that I was actually able to tell her something that she had missed in one of the environmental clues. And so that's a sensation I'm not terribly accustomed to in the context of puzzle games. But yeah, comparing notes about such things with a specific individual is much, much, much more fun than, say, going on Reddit and immediately being spoiled about all the pro strats.
Yes, that's for sure. So what did you end up thinking of it, Mark?
I hated it.
I figured.
So I didn't even hate it in the way that I thought I'd hate it.
Uh-huh.
Because if Blueprints were a board game, I wouldn't play it. And in many ways, it's very much like a board game.
Yeah.
You know, it's a tile-laying game where you draft from a set of tiles. And the sheer frequency with which I felt that my meta progression, as well as my progression within a run, were entirely at the mercy of what I would draw from the tile pool, I found so incredibly frustrating. Normally, the roguelike meta progression works whereby, through a combination of not having the right buffs and just because you're getting good at the game, you'll just fail and fail and fail and fail. But the game never interposes its direct hand, points at you and says, you're done now. We're not going to let you go anymore. You'd best quit because I've said you're finished.
Yeah.
When I run out of steps, it doesn't feel like that.
Yeah.
It feels like I had a resource that I wasted. But when I am consciously drafting to maximize my available doors, and I just keep drafting dead ends and L's that lead to rooms that I've already placed, and consequently the run is over, and there was nothing I could have done about it. And when I know that so many of the puzzles are, well, you need room X and you need room Y, and if you've drafted both of those rooms, then if you draft room Z, you'll be able to do the thing. And the game just will not let me draft room Y, and I've already got X and Z, or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I'm playing a puzzle game. I feel like I'm playing a slot machine. And I do not enjoy that part at all. And the proportion of blueprints that is about drawing the right rooms is maddening to me. I cannot fathom how people who enjoy puzzles are able to tolerate it. It's so weird. It's one thing to have to explore the house and find the necessary elements of meta progression so that on your next run or what have you, you've discovered the clues. So when you're presented with the puzzle again, it's like, I've been here before. I know what I'm doing. I've got all the things together.
Yeah.
But it's not particularly revelatory to understand that to open the garage room door, you need to have the breaker room so you can supply power to the garage and just not draft the relevant rooms. That doesn't feel like an organic puzzle-solving experience to me. It feels like the meta progression is being gatekept not behind my skill and not behind my buying the right buffs. It's gatekept behind a giant random number generator. And it drives me batty. I don't get it.
So I definitely experienced those things. I don't know. I feel like I was able to set it aside. Be like, okay, I clearly am not drafting this. Or, you know, if I happen to draft these two rooms, fantastic. I can finally go solve that puzzle. I definitely think that the way that I played Blueprints was more like, let's see what I happen to get. And then it's going to be great. Maybe. Because if you go in trying to find a particular room, it's going to be so frustrating. I mean, I did have that issue. I was trying to draft the bookstore or the bookshop, whatever. It's a very rare thing. I've only seen it a couple times. I had loads of money and I was like, finally, if I draw the bookshop, I'll be able to buy a book. I did not buy a book.
In fairness, I would have much more enthusiasm if when all the stars aligned, I had a better confidence that I was actually getting the maximum benefit mm-hmm. out of what I've just stumbled into. Like there are a bunch of times while playing Blueprints, I get the solid sense that the game is trying to communicate something to me and my inability to process puzzles properly is just meaning that I'm not picking up what the game is putting down. I'm confident that there's a lot of that. And so I would probably be more forgiving about the random arrangement of these things if I was fully benefiting from those rare times when the game finally coalesces. But I can say for certain, whether or not you enjoy puzzles, I'm again surprised, given how at the mercy you are, even setting aside your tolerance towards the random number generation, could they have at least tried to make it a little more atmospheric when you're wandering through these rooms that you've seen a bunch of times before? And I don't mean to keep harping on the absence of music, but it is a good example of how Blueprints doesn't seem to want to make the 17th time you've drafted a bedroom getting from point A to point B with your slow walk speed remotely enjoyable. Now, yeah, you have to look to see if there's a trunk or a little gem that's not supposed to be there. Sure, fine. That is at least makes it something beyond pure autopilot. But I was surprised at, like you said, Blueprints doesn't seem to respect my time very much. The proportion of new and interesting stuff, or stuff that I cared about, even setting aside my disdain for puzzles, was very small.
Mm-hmm.
Sure enough, I would get to the boiler room or the pump room, and then there was something that was demonstrably a puzzle involving valves or water levels or whatever. And I'd flip at some things and flail around like a monkey doing a math problem and be like, oh, I'd probably get a lot more out of this if I had a better sense of how to solve puzzles. Sure. And if that were happening more often,
mm-hmm.
I'd still dislike Blueprints. But I'd have a better sense about why other people liked it so much. But as it is, as you say, there's actually a relatively small amount of actual puzzles going on, like in terms of traditional gameplay puzzles. Like, what Blueprints calls a puzzle is getting lucky with your draft, I think, all too often. And that's just weird.
Yeah. Because not only do you have to make sure, or not even make sure, hopefully you're able to collect enough resources in the lower rooms that you're able to get through all of the higher rooms to get to, you know, hopefully get to room 46, however you get there. But there's certainly, like, the stars need to align in sometimes frustrating ways. I found that that got easier over time as you upgrade rooms, because you get these upgrade discs and you can put them into any computer, and then they'll let you upgrade a certain, like, it's random, but it'll give you a room that you could upgrade, and it gives you three different blueprints that you can change it to. So, for example, one of mine was, like, I had a spare hallway, which is a nothing room, and I could change it into a green room or a hallway. Technically, it kind of already was a hallway, but it wasn't a hallway according to blueprints, or some other thing. Those will synergize with other rooms, which is kind of cool, especially the green rooms. The green rooms have this big thing going on where, you know, you have one green room, maybe it's not so great, but if you have five green rooms, then maybe you can get, you know, you'll get something out of it. So I ended up making mine into a green spare hall or spare room. But I really liked how the upgrades could help, but the number of times also that I ended up with an upgrade disc, but no computer to put the upgrade disc in.
Yep.
Or the number of times I called it a day and then was like, no, I had an upgrade disc and I completely forgot I had it. I almost would have appreciated like a little thing being like, hey, you have an upgrade disc. Are you sure you want to call it a day?
Sure. I was surprised at how few room interactions there were.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe this is just because I've got a board game addled brain, but I was half expecting when, you know, just experimenting around, playing around with the different things, trying to discover things. I was expecting, like, you put four rooms of the same color in a 2x2 square, or two rooms in a line of the same color, or of the right color combinations or whatever, to unlock things or do something. And I was very disappointed when I started to internalize, not really.
Yeah.
Like, the interactions with colors are explicitly called out, and it doesn't really matter unless the game tells you that it matters. And that immediately put a damper on my sense of playing around with the drafting. It was a very particular expectation that I had for no good reason, and I was strangely disappointed when it didn't manifest.
Yeah, and it at the very start of Blueprints, there's not a whole lot of room interactions. I think all the ones, or not all, most of the ones outside of the green rooms, because the green rooms have lots of interactions built in with other green rooms, but I think all of the other ones I ran into were from upgrade discs. And you have to find a decent number of those before that starts to feel good.
The nursery is part of the initial draft.
Oh, the nursery too. You're right. I forgot about the nursery.
Yeah. I was also, for what it's worth, when I got the first upgrade disc, I'm like, ah, here's the meta progression. And then it was, I think the best option available was this kind of room will now spawn with a key. I'm like, great.
Yeah.
I'm really glad that I waited for the random allocation of these three precise rooms just so I could get this for future runs. Hot.
Yeah, honestly, like, when you brought up board games, I do think that there's some stuff that they could have learned from board games or pulled in from board games that could have made laying out the rooms in the house feel a little bit more interesting or fun. Because as it is, the primary goal always, or almost always, in Blueprints is to make sure that you always have doors. And it would be nice to sometimes have a different goal in mind that you can, you know, that you want to accomplish rather than just doors, doors, doors.
It's very validating to hear that because it was my impression, not having achieved very much in Blueprints, having flailed around with it like someone who's not very good at the game, that broadly speaking, your goal was to place as many rooms as possible, to always have a way out, to get more doors, so to place more rooms, to increase the number of times you get to draft from a pool so as to place things. And this is a gross overgeneralization, but another mutual friend of ours, Woogie, whenever he plays a board game where there's a draft of, say, three cards available on the table, his question is always, why is it three? Why not make it five? Why not make it six? More choice is better than less choice. And Blueprints, I'm not saying that it could just double the range of draft for every time. You'd require some rebalancing there. But the point is that the game lives or dies based on the tiles that it gives you. And that, I find, a strange way to gate progression when compared to a lot of other roguelike or roguelite games, frankly.
So it's completely possible that this is meta progression that I never ran into. But there are dice that you can run into that will allow you to reroll. And I was expecting at some point to get some of those automatically upon starting, just to give a few more options. That never happened for me. I don't know if that exists somewhere in the bowels of the house in Blueprints. That would have been really nice.
Insofar as I could give tangible advice to make Blueprints more to my liking, it probably would be, why are you so parsimonious with dice? Mm-hmm. Let me reroll the draft more often. When I first got the drafting room, get it? Drafting room? You draw drafting, you draft tiles, mm-hmm. You draft a blueprint, blueprints, haha. Uh-huh. Wordplay, Caitlin. It said it lets you basically reroll all of your room picks. I thought that was going to apply to everywhere for the rest of the run. And I thought, finally.
That would have been so good.
But no, it's just the rooms off of the drafting room. And it's like, why are you being so stingy?
Yeah.
The ratio of runs ended by dead ends is just way too high, I think. But
yeah.
And make no mistake, I was almost always drafting for maximum number of doors all the time. And still, I would very frequently end up with busted runs.
Yeah, the same happened for me. As I progressed through Blueprints, that happened less and less. I was eventually able to... I still haven't fully filled up the house because I never have... Like, there's always some kind of RNG that bites me, and I always have some, you know, something blocked off that I can't get to. And over time, it did get easier to get higher and higher and higher. But the number of times still, even late game, where I'd be like, well, I have to call this one because there's nowhere else I can go. I'm out of keys. Or I just happen to... The one room that I just think is terrible, I just think it's overall, like, why would you ever want this, is the archive room, where it's like, yeah, you can't see one of the things you're drafting now. Sorry. It's like, come on, like, it's bad enough just having the three, and now I can only see two of them?
Yeah, three was way too much choice. Now you should be down to one or two choice.
Yeah, so it's like, okay, I don't like that, don't like that. You only live once. Let's click the hidden one. Oh, it's a dead end. I guess this is it.
Well, I'm very glad you enjoyed Blueprints. You were able to pick up what it was putting down.
Yes.
Again, if it were more atmospheric, or if I were better able to parse some of the puzzles that it was trying to present to me, I'd probably be more forgiving. But as it is, structurally, I find Blueprints very uninspired.
Yeah, I completely understand with the lack of, I don't know, it just feels like it should be moodier. Like, not necessarily in a like sad, bad way, but like just have personality somewhere, please.
I will say this, though. I half expected my experience with Blueprints to be exhausted by entering the starting room, being presented with a puzzle, not being able to solve it, and that being it.
Same.
Sincerely.
Yeah.
It wouldn't have shocked me if that had been what was going on. I just would have been able to shrug and be like, okay, well, that was a thing.
Yeah, I was pleasantly surprised that that was not the case.
So that's Blueprints, available on Game Pass as well, for what it's worth. We will now proceed to some shameless hyping of upcoming titles. Caitlin, what would you like to shout out?
So today, I'm going to shout out Malice. It is a new game in development from the creators of Stray Gods. One of the co-founders is David Gaider, who is known for his work on Dragon Age. And it's a roguelite deck builder, and I think it looks pretty cool. So I'm going to be keeping an eye out for it.
Is this by Summerfell Studios, currently on Kickstarter, and also the game that I was going to be shouting out?
Yeah, I guess so.
This crossed my attention, I think, because my newsfeed is calibrated towards things like former lead raider of the Dragon Age series. And it doesn't look like the campaign is going to fund. I went to the crowdfunding page, and things don't look too good at the moment. It's tough to tell. And crowdfunding PC games is fraught at the best of times, given the proportion of them that just don't come to fruition. But I am usually willing to try a new deck builder PC game. And if David Gaider's involved, then I'm certainly willing to give it a shot.
Yeah, it looks like it's like 50K out of 166. I guess that's US dollars, with 25 days to go. So we'll see. It's a decent percent, but it's not... Sometimes these are very overwhelming right away, so...
It's true. It's just generally speaking with crowdfunding, if you don't make significant distance towards your target in the initial 2 or 3 days, that could be a very bad sign. There are exceptions, of course, But as a general pattern, you really want to generate a lot of momentum in the early moments of the campaign. Yeah.
So we'll see. I hope it makes it, because it looks interesting. So that does it for another episode of All My Best Friends Are Digital, a podcast about video games and the stories they tell. If you would like to support our work, you can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/ampfad. And that'll do it. Thank you, everyone. Hope you all have a wonderful week.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to get in touch, you can reach us at allmybestfriendsaredigital@gmail.com. Hope to see you again soon.
6 months from now, you could be running a 5K, booking that dream trip, or seeing thicker, fuller hair every time you look in the mirror. Through Hers, you can get dermatologist-trusted, clinically proven prescriptions with ingredients that go beyond what over-the-counter products offer. Whether you prefer oral or topical treatments, Hers has you covered. Getting started is simple. Just fill out an intake form online, and a licensed provider will recommend a customized plan just for you. The best part? Everything is 100% online. If prescribed, your treatment ships right to your door. No pharmacy trips, no waiting rooms, and no insurance headaches. Plus, treatments start at just $35 a month. Start your initial free online visit today at forhers.com/talk. That's forhers.com/talk. Tantandia products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Price varies both on product and subscription plan. See website for full details, restrictions, and important safety information.
Want to keep your personal number private but still stay connected? With Line 2, you can get a second phone line right on your device with a super simple app and no need for another phone. Whether it's for online shopping, dating, or shielding your main number from spam, Line 2 is an easy way to manage it all. Ready for peace of mind without breaking the bank? Call, text, block, and more for only $9.99. Get started with line2.com/audio or download Line 2 in any app store today. Line 2, your second line simplified.